Dear Asian Girl, for Asian girls, by Asian girls.
Hey guys, this is Nina and I'm with Erin today, one of our new members. She'll be joining us as we talk to Jeanette on this episode about dynamics within Asian families. If you're a new listener here, this is Dear Asian Girl, a podcast for Asian girls by Asian girls. And we are so excited to have Jeanette Wu on here. She is the author of Letters to Home, which is a memoir. And yeah, would you mind giving us a brief explanation on your book, your background as a first gen Asian American, and just any other information you'd like our listeners to know about you?
Of course. Thank you so much, both of you guys, for having me today on this podcast. My name is Jeanette, and I am a American-born Chinese, born and raised in New York City. And recently, I published a book called Letters to Home, and it is a memoir, and also including other stories about, my experience as an American-born Chinese living and growing up in New York City. But yeah, this book is essentially a collection of letters and stories that dictated around my upbringing, dedicated to my parents, but also to other ABCs and just children of immigrant families. So I hope that this is an intersection between my identity as an ABC, as well as talking about stories about transgenerational gap, the cultural and language barriers around this topic, and everything else that comes up in between. But I'm just really excited to be here and talk to you guys. So thank you so much for having me.
The feeling is mutual. We're so excited about this. And like you said, we're just going to be doing this deep dive into sections of your book in terms of the topics we discuss, in terms of the intersectionalities of families and how generational gaps affect that, how the cultures you're raised in affects that. So I just want to get started in the expectations as the oldest daughter, if I'm correct, the oldest daughter.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yes, the oldest daughter in an Asian family, the responsibilities that comes alongside with that. And I just want to talk about how family expectations of overachievement, of pursuing the American dream and fulfilling all the hopes and dreams that your parents had immigrating or your grandparents had immigrating to America mm-hmm. from China. I would like to talk mm-hmm. about how that can lead to all these feelings of almost stress or overwhelm, or more specifically imposter syndrome, which we have discussed on this podcast previously quite early in one of our seasons. But imposter syndrome is something you've discussed in your book quite a bit mm-hmm. and how that relates to the double standards you've seen or witnessed in your family. So would you mind elaborating on that? Have any stories you'd like to share? We'd love to hear them.
Mm-hmm, of course. Yeah. So I think it's a really special role being the eldest and, female daughter within a Chinese household, because it's expected that you just carry a lot of family's burdens and responsibilities on your shoulders. And mostly because, my parents, they immigrated from a small city or town named Taishan in China. So coming over here, a lot of it is that, none of them speak English and they really have to start from scratch. So being able to start from the bottom is something that I hold really heavily inside me, because as I grow up, it's like I understand more about my family history, where they come from, how they're being perceived by other people and society. So as I grow up, I have to be able to, step into my role as the eldest daughter, to be the translator, be the engineer, be all these types of roles that normally, parents who already speak English, they're able to already automatically assume, and they don't have to lay that responsibility to their children. As I was growing up, even though my parents and my parents were able to speak English and able to, carry themselves in society and everything, but then for my grandparents, it's a lot harder for them. And for them, when they first came here, they lived in like a small apartment in Chinatown in New York City. So they worked in like a clothing factory day and night while my parents worked. They went to school and then they also worked part-time jobs and everything. But then in comparison to me, as I grew up, all I have to worry about is school. For them, it's like they have so much more to worry about. And for me, I'm in a lot better position. I'm just a lot more grateful for that. So leading on to how that leads with imposter syndrome is that as I was growing up, even though I had this responsibility and I'm very grateful for being able to grow up in New York City, it also leads to imposter syndrome, because you have this association between your academic achievements and how that relates to your self-worth. And a lot of that comes with thinking that, oh, like if I get like 100 or like a 99 on the test, that means that, oh, my parents will be super proud of me. And that means that it's very worthwhile for them to travel all this way just to come over here. But then as that builds up over time, it leads to low self-esteem, low confidence, and just thinking that your entire self-worth, who you are as a person, your identity, is only because of getting good grades and having all of these high academic achievements. It ends up building up to this like fear of failure, fear of taking risk. And this is something that I feel like I'm still constantly working on, you know, going on with this whole like personal growth journey. I realized that for me, with this whole fear of failure, if I am not willing to do something, or if I don't end up pursuing something, I won't end up failing at something. And this is not, and this is like a mindset that I'm trying to constantly work at. And I think that this is an effect of imposter syndrome that I'm always going to be constantly working on. And relating to the book, as I was writing this back in the beginning of the pandemic, so I started this around June 2020 up until this past September, there were so many moments throughout this entire book journey where I was just like, oh, like I'm not good enough, or who am I to write a memoir at, you know, 22, 23 years old? All the other memoirs that I've written are by, you know, Michelle Obama and like people who are well established in their industry. So when I think back about my own writing experience and, you know, my experience just growing up as an ABC, I'm thinking, oh, like maybe I could wait until 10 years later or 20 years later when I am more established and more aware of everything that's going around me in order to write this book. But being able to condense all of that and being able to talk to yourself and thinking that, oh, like everything is okay, that this is just a byproduct of imposter syndrome, is something that I have to constantly battle. And ultimately lead me to publish this book.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's so great. So again, for listeners who don't know, I'm Erin. I'm one of the new podcast researchers. I really resonate a lot with that experience of just feeling like my self-worth is attached to grades so much. But one thing that I think I'm like starting, because like I'm a first year in college, one thing that I am really starting to, I guess, navigate, is this sort of dichotomy between this like Western education system, because I go to a liberal arts college. So obviously freedom and creativity of thought, those are things that are very much valued and very much, that is like what is appreciated. That is like the center of education kind of. And I'm also at this time trying to reconcile with this attachment that I have like to like my grades and self-worth, and it is difficult sometimes because at my college we have this thing where it's like, oh, we're not allowed to like talk about grades because there's like a taboo around that as well. Mm-hmm. But for me, for my entire life, like you're talking about, grades have been the priority for my family. Like you need to like be the president of like 10 different clubs, have all these extracurriculars and stuff, but at the same time, like I'm dealing with like this education system that's telling me that, oh yeah, you're allowed to be creative and you're allowed to be like a cool person who like does this like array of mm-hmm. things. So how have you, in like your own kind of personal experience, like navigated the sort of dichotomy between like the Western education system that prioritizes mm-hmm. this freedom of thought versus your own parent and family dynamics that have stressed like this cultural dynamic that has stressed grades as being like the epitome of education?
Yeah, this is something that I definitely think about all the time. It's like when I was thinking, because then I studied in China and I learned so much about the education system and how they think and the values that are instilled in them. And then I compare it to what I grew up with growing up in the New York City public school system, where what he said about, you know, freedom of speech and creativity and critical thinking, all this comes up. And at times when I think about my Chinese values, it's this collective Beehive mentality that, oh, like we have to believe in one thing because, you know, we're stronger united, and having one thought is easier than having so many different sporadic, you know, random thoughts that often conflict with each other. So when stuff like this comes up, I often think to myself, it's kind of like at a better stage for me to be able to have these two school thoughts, because when having it, I'm able to compare them and take out the best, kind of like the best of both worlds and merge them together when tackling any situation. So for me, when I'm in a situation where, oh, like I have a certain perspective or view on a topic, but then my parents might not agree because they grew up in a different education system. They grew up in a different background. They might not understand the same things that I do because they didn't go to school with me. They're not my classmates. So when I try to grapple with that, it's understanding where they're coming from, but at the same time, recognizing that my own perspective is also valid because, you know, we grew up in a more progressive and liberal society, even though we may have different perspectives, but it's okay because that's, you know, the beauty of, you know, being a human being and to be able to talk to other people with different views.
Yeah, I really relate to that because I recently, why am I saying recently? It's been a year already, wow, time flies. But actually exactly a year ago from tomorrow, I had moved to Singapore from Los Angeles, which is where I'm currently.
Wow.
Yeah, that's so awesome. I really relate to what you said about the clear like differences in the major juxtaposition that's between the two systems. Like when I went to a Singaporean local school, which wasn't the plan originally, was to immerse me in an international setting so I wouldn't be too out of my depth, out of my element. But I went to a local school for a brief period of time. And one of my teachers, my business teacher, she had pulled me over and like wanted to hear my thoughts on the different systems and had immediately assumed that I was like really opposed to how strict the Singapore marking scheme is, because the way it is much different from the American school system, where like you have to have very clear, precise ways and methods of showing work based on the teacher, not necessarily like the overall subject. And especially as a government school, it was just very strict in general. And that was like very overwhelming to me initially. But mm-hmm. I think there are definitely pros and cons with each system, like you mentioned. Like I feel like I've grown in terms of being able to have like a specific sub-directions and be able to interpret that and then use that and, you know, an interpretation then utilizing, I think that was like a really good skill to have. But mm-hmm. with the American system, I have more like experimental projects that are being assigned to me, more things that I feel like are what humanities tries to do for us, which is like think outside the box and be more experimental mm-hmm. and creative. So I definitely agree with you in terms of what you said about having that good mix and taking the goods of both systems that may seemingly defy themselves, but I think have a really good overall results. But yeah. You said something that reminded me of how you were in an interracial relationship, right? Mm-hmm. Has it lasted? Or I don't know if that's too personal, but
no, you're good. Yes, I'm currently in a long-term relationship with my boyfriend. We've been together for about 5.5 years now. It's going to be 6 in February.
Wow.
Thank you.
But it reminded me of that because you were talking about how the Asian or Chinese family mentality mm-hmm. is to be this collective beehive, meaning mm-hmm. you work together for the same purpose, the same goal. And with that in mind, the way you would view, the best way that you view achieving that is to have the same faiths, the same religion, mm-hmm. if you are religious, the same mm-hmm. cultural dynamics or backgrounds, so you can strive for the same goals. So mm-hmm. can you talk about how having a boyfriend who isn't of Chinese descent, how that may have been, how your family reacted, how that has been to navigate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely something that is still ongoing, you know. I wish that I could say that, oh, my parents are super open, they're progressive, they're open to, you know, me bringing anyone home, but that's not the case. So my boyfriend is Bengali American, and I'm Chinese American. So even though you know, we're the same age and like same age and everything, but then like to my parents that doesn't really matter because he doesn't come from a Chinese background. So going back to the whole, you know, collective beehive mentality thing, in Chinese culture it's just like you said, better to have everyone, you know, with the same values, with the same culture, you know, just looking the same. But then for me, what is more important is, you know, having the same, you know, we're able to vibe on the same frequency and being able to have the same values and interests and passions and everything. But with my parents, a lot of it is more about this concept of saving face in Chinese culture. And this is not to bash them and everything, it's just how they grew up and what Chinese culture or like traditional Chinese culture, what they value. And saving faith, essentially, being able to have that, like I said, that collective mentality, but also being able to prevent anyone from standing out. So it's kind of like you're able to protect yourself and your family from looking to, you know, like looking different from everyone else. And by doing so, you know, this conflicts with my decision to be in an interracial relationship with my boyfriend. And I'm constantly still navigating that, because for me, the way that they met is very funny, because we've been in a relationship for about, I think, 3 years at that point. And before I decided to tell my parents, I was gonna move to China for a year. So I was thinking that, oh, if they're to get mad at me, I'm just going to move anyway. So it doesn't really matter. But then I told them, you know, on my birthday, and they can't get mad at me for on my birthday. I was like, hey, like, I'm bringing somebody. And they're like, okay, who? And then they're like, I'm like, it's a boy. And then 5 minutes later, they're like, so you have a boyfriend? And I was like, yep. He was like, does he speak Chinese? And I was like, yes, but he is not Chinese. So for me, it's still an ongoing learning process of being able to convince and expose my parents to the, you know, the kind-hearted and really sincere and compassionate person that my boyfriend is, and being able to look past his background as a Bengali and all the other differences that may come up in that relationship, but exposing them to, you know, just him as a human being and how our relationship is very, you know, warm and sincere. So to be able to have that is still an ongoing process, but something that I have to look forward to. Yeah.
Definitely. So another thing that I really want to talk about that it's related to this is that I know that Chinese families, they utilize acts of service, and it makes having another love language, like words of affirmation, it makes that inaccessible in a way, because there are these other ways of communicating love as well that maybe aren't viewed as like this common, like American, like version of like love, you know? So how do you think that like these Chinese societal norms, how do you think they have influenced the way in which like love and affection are expressed, like especially from the parents?
Yeah, of course. So I talked a little bit in this book about just how, at least in my family, the primary love language is acts of service. And I brought up the scene in the book where I, you know, was studying really hard for my AP test, and I was really stressed out, and just, you know, hunched over my desk. It's probably like 11 p.m. or something. And I hear this knock on the door, and I just get really paranoid and annoyed. And then I open the door, and it's my mom. And I was like, what do you want? And she gives me this bowl of fruit. And then I was just very taken aback by it, but she didn't say anything. She was like, oh, like, just, besides like, oh, here, have this fruit. But thinking back on it, a lot of it is just that, you know, like she comes at my door, she knows that I'm studying, and she brings this bowl of fruit as a gesture of, hey, like I care about you, stay healthy and do everything and do whatever you got to do, but I'm here for you if you need anything. But she doesn't say any of that. All she does is gives you a bowl of fruit. So going back to the whole acts of service thing, at least for my family, they provided in a sense, not of, oh, like they didn't help me with my homework or they didn't help me with my projects, but they did help me with everything else in terms of, you know, providing food and care and shelter. So for them, it's a lot more about doing things for me versus providing me words of affirmation, like, hey, like you got this, you can do this. And I think that like we said about before, like there's a lot of pros and cons to that. And for me, it took a really long time for me to recognize that, here, have a bowl of fruit is the same thing as, oh, I care about you, I love you.
Yeah, that's something that I was just about to ask you about, because I know, well, personally, I am a transracial adoptee. So I'm a Chinese adoptee. I was born in China, so I am an immigrant. My parents are Caucasian, but my mom sort of, she was very much about like stressing that sort of education. And I'm sure there are other issues as well, being adopted. But one thing that I recently told her, we had like this very intimate conversation, was that I didn't realize that she loved me until like 2 years ago. And that's when I'd gone back to China and I'd met my foster family. And that was a really meaningful experience for me. But I think because I was talking to her the other day, and she was like, I never really like stressed your happiness, you know, like, or I always stressed, I wanted you to become the best version of yourself, but your happiness was never at the forefront. It was more about education, which might seem harsh, I think, in sort of like this Western way of looking at it. But again, going back to this idea of like dichotomies as well, because you said it took you a long time to realize that oh, these acts of service, this is love, you know? So how has that process been in like reconciling with this is what love is? Like, it's not like this necessarily what you see on like media portrayals of love being like, oh, like, I love you, you're great, you're like the star, the center of the universe. I know some of my peers have gotten as well. How have you kind of reconciled with this dichotomy, and have you actually talked to your parents about this directly?
Yeah, I think that, like you said, a lot of it comes from recognizing that there's so many different forms of love. And this doesn't necessarily come through what the media portrays as, oh, like, I love you directly. Because I mentioned in the book how it's like, I was really taken aback when I was watching these American TV shows or movies where, you know, like, the child would come down, the teenager would come down from the stairs, and they're like, hey, like, mom, going to school. And then the mom goes like, hey, like, I love you. And then they grab a piece of toast or bacon, whatever, and they head out. So when I watch that on TV, I'm just like, this doesn't happen. But recognizing that, oh, like, as I'm growing older, there's so many different forms of love that goes beyond what we see in the media. Part of it is accepting that every culture and every background and every family has their own dynamic. And even though their dynamic doesn't look like yours, it doesn't mean that it's still, doesn't mean that it's not love. And for me, it's also about recognizing that your relationship with yourself, like coming in the form of self-love, recognizing that your worth, like, you are still worthy, you are still loved, even if nobody tells you that you are loved. At least, like, in terms of my relationship with my parents, like, even though we haven't spoken about it directly, but it's sort of this, you know, unspoken communication where it's like, hey, like, have you eaten yet? Or like, are you hungry? Like, that type of, that sort of thing, where, because they've been saying it to me all my life, like, it's only right that I also use their love language to reciprocate the love back to them.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it, I feel like, is about accessibility. Whether that's through like navigating language differences or having these time constraints due to jobs, long commutes that you have to deal with. I think as an immigrant or an Asian immigrant, you will come to the country and not prioritize necessarily love and belonging. And I had, in the outline that we're using for this episode, I actually mentioned Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is a form of thought about motivation and sort of the prioritization of motivation. And at the bottom of the hierarchy, first and foremost, is safety. And that will be your needs that revolve around food or water, shelter, etc. And then above that, I believe there is some other category. And then above that, there is love and belonging. And I think with this Asian survival mentality as the collective beehive that we said earlier, it's really in the forefront of immigrants' brain to focus on the safety aspect of things. And maybe that will cause love and affection to be not necessarily neglected, but put off to the side because it's not the utmost priority for surviving in this new country that may be really overwhelming. And I did want to ask about how that sort of survival mentality affected you, how you saw that play out in your family dynamic. And I think this is sort of a topic that may not be related, but I think there is some connection to it because you also talked a lot about death stigma in your book. And I think the way that I'd love for you to describe the story of that death, if you feel comfortable to our listeners, I think the way in which you tried to overcome that death and overcome the grief really quickly, it's such a really real representation of how ingrained that survival mentality is. So could you describe what dealing with that death was to our listeners and just how that relates to that survival mentality?
Yeah, so this whole thing with the survival mentality is also something that came up during the pandemic. You know, we have so much time to self-reflect and to think about our role in the universe and just how we should carry ourselves in a society that we just is so ever-changing and evolving, especially with the pandemic, filled with so much uncertainty. Death is really put at the forefront of what we're used to. We always have this date of expiration that we don't know what it is, but you know that it's there. But with the pandemic, everyone just becomes more aware of this expiration date and being able to process and cope with it. But for me, in the book, during this pandemic and during this period of uncertainty, I was able to write this chapter relating to my grandfather's passing. And out of all the chapters in the book and out of all the stories that I've written, it's probably the one that taken the most time and was also the hardest to write, not only because of how dense it is, but also because I never really got a chance to unpack these feelings for myself. So even before I wrote the chapter, it was a lot about talking to myself and recognizing that these feelings are bubbled in and like packed inside of me, but there was never a chance or a place or a time where I'm able to safely unpack those feelings and to be able to verbalize them and put them down on paper. So with my grandfather's passing, this happened about 3 years ago, something like that. And this happened like during the midst of my finals and, you know, amidst of all the other responsibilities and priorities that I had. And I remember when it happened, it was really abrupt and something that we knew that it was in, you know, in the distance, but we didn't know that it was going to be so soon. So when it happened, like, I was thinking that, oh, like, I have all these finals, I have all these projects, all these deadlines, but all I could think about was that, as opposed to being able to process and cope with this very natural phenomenon that is death. And in the book, I write about how in that period of time, I had to sort of click off or like switch that switch and be able to think that, oh, this doesn't matter right now. My grandfather's passing doesn't matter right now. I have to worry about my deadlines. And this links back to this whole like survival mentality and also this like death stigma in the Chinese culture, because at least in my family, we didn't talk about it at all because of how big of a taboo topic it is. Like, you know how in Chinese culture, the number 4 is very superstitious, and Chinese people don't even want to live in a house number with a number 4 in it, or even live on the 4th level of a building, because to them, it thinks that it invites death and like a lot of inauspicious things. So for me, we didn't talk about it at all in our family. It's not, there's like a lack of discussion, lack of transparency. So when it did happen, when my grandfather's passing did happen, not only was it a new experience, but it was something that, even though it's a natural phenomenon, but then there's not enough conversations about it in the media to be able to understand what is the correct solution or what is the correct like coping mechanism and process for this. So through this book, I wanted to be able to also resonate with other people who have maybe gone through a similar experience. I'm here for you. Like, I know that this is a really hard time. I know that this is something that you may not talk about with your family, but I know that, but just know that this is something that I will always be here for you for.
I know as well, like for like myself, something that I don't let myself do is I don't let myself like process things and like bad things happen. Because I have this, like, there's absolutely like such mentality that, oh no, I need to like get over it. Like, I'm not gonna like wallow or like be like sad and like in like my feelings about it. And I think that's something that's also perpetuated by Chinese culture as well, kind of this having to overcome death, especially quickly and you through like numbness and this dissociation. How have you kind of dealt with this sort of cultural mindset of not being able to have the time to self-process, but at the same time like needing to process?
So I think that, like you said, with this whole Chinese, you know, stigma and taboo topic about that, it was really hard for me to have a healthy coping outlet for me to be able to process my grandfather's passing. But I think that a lot of it comes down to me recognizing that, or allowing myself the space and the time to heal. And unfortunately, it took me a long time until like this pandemic, and even as I was writing this chapter, I felt like I was able to allow myself to do that. Because up until then, a lot of it is about, you know, the next deadline, the next project, whatever the next competing priority is. And especially with the whole New York City hustle and bustle, having this time and space to have for yourself to heal is sort of like a privilege, because when you're spending time to heal, at least for me back then, it was time taken away from doing another project or like studying for something else, and have a better understanding of how to cope and how to help others who are also going through the same process. And I feel like a lot of this also comes with having more open conversations about it and being more transparent about our feelings and being able to put a label on and be like, oh, like this is how I'm feeling right now and this is how I feel like I should process this, as opposed to stuffing it all down, using numbness as like a coat of armor and being like, oh, like it's fine, like I'll deal with this later when I have more time. But in reality, there's never a best time to cope.
And I know as well, I'm not a published writer,
No problem.
I do write quite a little bit. I'm primarily a poet, but definitely one thing that I know that I use as sort of like a healthy outlet or a healthy coping mechanism is like creating art or like writing and like putting that out there. And that's definitely something that you were talking about, using art as kind of this like catharsis as well. And like, do you think like that, like the act like of like writing the book that itself was like this like catharsis, like of like putting it out into the world, of like kind of having it for like everybody else to see? Do you think like that was part of your process of like writing the book?
For sure. It's like, this is something that I've mentioned at the I think maybe like page one, where one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book is because I wanted to put myself or get comfortable with this feeling of being uncomfortable. Because for me growing up, it was a lot more about, okay, you do your work, you sit down, you put your head down, and you worry about your own thing. So for me, speaking up about my own feelings, about my own thoughts and perspectives is something that I'm not used to. And being able to assert myself in a way and take up my own space was something that felt really uncomfortable for me. So be able to have my own platform, my own book to verbalize all of these things was a very surreal experience. And being able to share some of these memories and stories that even my closest friends don't have no idea that I've been through is something that it's like another step forward in this personal journey process. But for sure, like writing this book and being able to not only share and tell the stories, but also relive some of these memories. It's like something that is really going to cherish for the rest of my life, and to be able to have a physical form of it as like a legacy project, to be able to show my kids and be like, hey, like when I was 22, 23, these were my perspective, these are my thoughts. They may have changed 10 or 20 years later, but it's still ingrained in some form. And recognizing that as humans, we are ever evolving creatures. So it's normal for things to change, for our perspectives to change. But as long as we, you know, stay true, stay genuine, and stay kind to people, like that's all that matters.
Yeah, I think that example of your book writing process, as well as the way that you would try to cope with death in the most discreet, almost invisible manner, I think that is like the perfect representation. Not perfect, it's not ideal at all, but it's a very clear showcase of how this Asian American survival mentality is mixed in with the toxic productivity culture in NYC. And I think you are this end result that shows how that can be very toxic and very grueling to deal with, and how you had mentioned earlier the concept of saving face and having this sort of polished exterior in order to have a good reputation for your family. And I think that plays into another concept you talked about in your book, which is double consciousness. I'd love for you to elaborate, but for our listeners who are unfamiliar with that, it's, I don't think I would give that much of a good explanation as much as you could, but to do it some justice, it's just when you have this perception of yourself and how other people may perceive you, it's a lot of just self-perceptiveness and awareness and how others may perceive you due to your race, other aspects of your identity. And I remember there was an anecdote in your book where you're talking about how the way your mom would interact with coworkers and how that would be interpreted as distant, detached, avoidant, just because she'd be very professional and not too friendly, quote unquote, in terms of American standards. So how would you say that this intersection between survival and like productivity, how do you think that is a result of this double consciousness and wanting to have that perfect exterior in terms of not showing your emotions or showing like any cracks in the glass from topics of death or fear from things of COVID or family experiences?
Yeah, for sure. Because for this term double consciousness, I read about when I took a course in college. And this is from the book, The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois. And for him, it was talking more about, oh, how you're able to see oneself through the lens of the oppressor. And I was sort of able to adopt some of this term. And being able to see myself as an American-born Chinese, but also through the lens of other people who may only see me as, you know, just like a Chinese person or just like an Asian person, just like walking through the streets of New York. And at least from my perspective, I think that, oh, even though I may see myself a certain way, but then for other people, they may see me as just another model minority. And, you know, just somebody else who's trying to get themselves out there and, you know, continue on with this hamster wheel of going through the hustle and bustle of New York. And in this book, I talked more about how I had to be able to grapple with all these conflicting values. With that example that you mentioned about how I had this like character, her name is like Xiaomei, but then her coworker calls her Mei for short because they're not able to pronounce her real Chinese name, and how this coworker kept on, you know, persisting, oh, like do this, even though it's outside of her responsibilities. But then for her, it's like, oh, like I want to be able to say face and I don't want to say no, but then I don't want to say yes. And to the coworker, it may seem that, oh, she's just, you know, very detached. Because for Xiaomei, like she's a lot more in tune with Chinese culture and with this whole concept of saving face, that she wants to be able to avoid conflict of any kind. But that deals with how I sort of try to carry myself in society, where I'm very aware of how others perceive me, but then I also want to stand my ground and be able to recognize that, hey, like I am allowed to take up space. I'm allowed to be my own person outside of this box that everyone puts me in, outside of this model minority role that everyone thinks that I am. But being able to grapple with that is something that I have to constantly deal with, but it's something that, you know, it's always evolving and constantly learning through.
Yeah, definitely. Something that like I know as well, just like saying like no to people. Yeah. It's been very difficult for me because it's this whole like model minority stigma of being, oh yeah, you're like this docent, like submissive, like Asian mm-hmm. woman. So you're supposed to go with the flow and just like let people just like take things from you kind of. And that's mm-hmm. definitely something that I've been more conscious about, I think, or something that I will be in the new year. It's a new year's resolution mm-hmm. that I've definitely had people take advantage of me because I've just had this sort of like, oh yeah, this is the way I'm supposed to be. But definitely something that I would love to like kind of like relate this to as well, just to kind of close this, is that taking up space and all mm-hmm. that's definitely something that I've been aware of as well. And having this publication of the book, that is like a declaration to the world kind of like, oh yeah, I am taking up space. I have this mm-hmm. voice and I'm not going to just be this submissive, like Asian, letting everything kind of just like pass over. You're like, I'm taking agency as well and mm-hmm. kind of like publishing this book. So I guess, and like my like question sort of is like in like publishing your book, how has that kind of like helped you to be like, oh yeah, I am taking up space mm-hmm. and this is who I am, and I'm not going to just be this model minority Chinese woman. I'm going to be, I am a Chinese American, and it's not mm-hmm. just, I'm not just Chinese or American. I'm like this yeah. this hybrid of both, this like intermixing, this blending of these two cultures. This is like our own third like kind of like space sort of yeah. That's what I refer to it as. So could you talk a little bit about like the publication taking up space?
Everything that you said about how you're able to, like for me, I guess it's a lot more about being able to control your narrative and be able to own your voice and how that aligns with your life. Because like as I was writing this book, I was very, very meticulous and very detail oriented about how what story fits into aspects of the book. And but part of it is also that I wanted to, as I'm publishing this book, I recognize that, oh, like I have this space on a bookshelf, and I know that if anyone picks it up who is unaware of my story, they're able to get a glimpse of that, even if they have no idea anything about like Chinese culture or like about my upbringing. But to be able to have that space on a page on a bookshelf somewhere is kind of like a very representative act of how I also want to represent the stories of other people who are also like me. But it's a very empowering process because it's not, it's like something that, oh, I'm not asking for anybody else's permission. But for me to be able to put this out there and be able to say that, hey, like there are many others like me who doesn't fit into this model minority role, who may be a doctor, who may be an engineer, but then they also have other pursuits outside of that. And recognizing that we are not willing to ask for permission anymore, but we're just going to be able to do whatever we want. And, you know, like this whole thing goes back to taking space and recognizing that we belong in this society, even if we still float in between the American and Chinese worlds, but we will gladly own up space, like, you know, pick up our role in that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was really profound. I love that. But yeah, I think just to close off on this, I feel like we've covered a lot of topics and this has been really great. I'd love to just hear some advice you would like to give to that like Asian eldest daughter who feels like she should take mm-hmm. everything upon her, that mm-hmm. Asian American girl who is like conflicted with the forms of love languages that she's receiving and feeling like confused by the conflicting American or Chinese ideals or any ideals culturally, that mm-hmm. the girl who's just afraid to be taking up space and be loud in this middle ground or third space that Erin eloquently put it as. What is some advice you'd like to give to those girls, or just advice or words of wisdom you give to yourself? That can be the mm-hmm. same thing, just any final words like that.
Yeah, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot, and more so, you know, as I'm growing up and having more experiences throughout life. But I would just recommend that whenever you do something, just ask yourself, are you doing this for yourself, or are you doing this to please other people? Are you doing this to please your family? Are you doing this to please society or your friends or coworkers? Or are you even trying to mold yourself into this box that everyone says that you should put yourself in? And along with that, like being able to set your own definition of success, to be able to recognize that other people's success may look different from yours, but it doesn't mean that their success is equal to your failure. Something that I'm, you know, trying to constantly remind myself with. But yeah, like that's the main thing, to be able to recognize that you have your role in this universe, and it's okay if you're the one who's able to dictate what happens in your own universe.
That was really beautiful. Wow. Yeah. But I definitely relate to that. I think we often look towards our, especially as like an Asian person, when we aren't the most dominant role in society, we'll look to other people that are above ourselves in terms of hierarchy, whether it's elders or whether it's people that are not POC, we'll look to them for the guidelines or the parameters in which we should act. But I think that was really good, just having your own definition and metric of success and what will please mm-hmm. you, not others, I think will be the most fulfilling as a person. So thank you so mm-hmm. much for that.
Yeah, of course.
I just want to say thank you so much for coming today. This is a really great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so grateful to be able to talk with other, you know, creatives and just individuals who have like-minded interests and just experiences, and to be able to have our own platform and stage for us to do that is really special. So thank you.
Want more of Dear Asian Girl? You can find us everywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. We're on everything. Can't get enough? Subscribe, follow, rate, review to get all the updates on the latest at DAG. Let us know your feedback and what we can do to improve. We also can be found on Instagram. Follow us at Dear Asian Girl to receive updates about our latest episodes and fun facts about the host. We'd love for you to reach out. DAG, Dear Asian Girl, a podcast dedicated to share the stories of Asian girls everywhere. For the Asian girl, by the Asian girl.